It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Welcome, guys, to Money for Lunch. Good to have you guys here, Money for Lunch Nation. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Money for Lunch Nation, Money for Lunch Tribe, Money for Lunch Legions, or Legions of Money for Lunch. Help me out. What should our community be referred to? The one with the best community title, you're going to get free dinner on me from Outback Steakhouse, or it's your choice. You can get you'll get a $50 gift certificate from Outback Steakhouse, or oh my goodness, let me look at it. I apologize. I have it here. Where is that? So it's Outback Steakhouse, Carrabba's, and or Fleming's. So come up with it, and then it's your choice. You can have a $50 gift certificate for any of those dining situations there, dining restaurants. You can also get $50 worth of Chick-fil-A and or Thirsty Lion. So man, we got you taken care of. And we have Smash Burgers. So come up, help me come up with a community that defines us, and you'll be handsomely rewarded. So anyway, I'm excited to have you here. I think that this is going to be a really eye-popping show. My first guest today is going to be helping us deal with this ugly thing called chargebacks. And now, if you own a business, sooner or later, this chargeback rears its ugly head. And so my first guest, Sri, and bear with me as I probably completely kill her name, but it's Sri Nivison. She's an avid entrepreneur, plus she's the CEO of Chargeback Gurus. Just love that. Chargeback Gurus. Easy to remember. A company she co-founded that helps online merchants win back up to 83% of their revenues lost to chargebacks, plus helps them protect themselves against further fraud and risk. Most of her clients' chargeback rates drop an under 2%, well below the industry norm, which can save them literally tens of thousands of dollars. Sri Nivison, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Bert, for that great introduction. Yes, you can call me Sri. I get it all the time. It's Srinivasan, and thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm excited to be here to talk about chargebacks. Unfortunately, the bane of the industry, but it's something that every business owner comes across and has to deal with.
Absolutely. So first of all, for those rare individuals who don't know what a chargeback is, why don't you talk about that? Tell us exactly what chargebacks are and how they affect our online business.
Oh, absolutely. A chargeback is when a customer disputes a transaction with their credit card company instead of calling the merchant. So, chargebacks can happen due to a variety of reasons. Sometimes the customer can say, hey, I did not get the product. I was not happy with the product. Or I don't recognize this charge. Oh, it's fraud. I never signed up for this. This is not what, why would they charge me? So many different reasons that they can give just to get a dispute on the file. And it affects businesses so much because, businesses, especially online businesses, lose billions of dollars every year. In fact, every quarter due to chargebacks and fraud, and this number is only rising. And also, if you get a certain number of chargebacks and you go above the threshold, your merchant account could even get shut down and your funds could be held. I've had that happen to some merchants before they came to us.
Yeah, no, this is unbelievable. A lot of people don't know this, but the chargeback threshold is like 1% or 2%. It's a very small amount.
Oh, yes. It's 1% or below 1%.
Yeah.
They want you to be below 1%.
And so what? And this is so offensive to me because that means that you have 99% of your charges are never a problem, but 1% could get you completely banned from that credit card processing company.
Yes, what they do is, you know, before they ban you, they could hold your funds, and they will put you on a chargeback management program. There are lots of fines and penalties, and you got to submit a detailed document with the plan, with an action plan. I mean, there are a lot of questions, so you got to prepare a plan and implement them and show them how you're going to reduce chargebacks. Tell them why you think you got those chargebacks in the first place, and then you got to implement those procedures, and they will watch you. And then, of course, they will implement more fees, and, you know, your rates could go up. You could get reserves. I mean, many, many things like that could happen. And that could put a lot of pressure on any business.
Absolutely. And again, this is an absurd threshold.
Yeah.
Because that means that 99% of your charges are non-problematic, but this 1% – that seems so reasonable to me, but yet the credit card company has you, they can abuse you. And I think that one of the other things that the credit card companies came out with, which to me is a made up thing so they can charge you more money, is they came out with this PCI, something compliance fee, and it's a ridiculous fee. It doesn't do anything with your chargebacks. It doesn't help you with your processing. It's just another way for them to charge you $100 every couple of years. So if they can't abuse you, they certainly will abuse you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the PCI compliance has to do with, you know, protecting the credit card information and the sensitive details of the customer, and especially if anybody or any system is storing the credit card numbers, yes, you got to be PCI compliant. You know, most merchants are not. You know, they don't have the time or the expertise. It requires a lot of money and also time and expertise to become compliant. And especially small, medium-level businesses, they don't need to be, but they have to pay that fee. You're right. You're right. They just want to impose more fees, and it's more restrictions on merchants so that they can protect the banks want to protect themselves too. So they pass on those fees and everything to the merchants.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's talk about this. I want to talk about you have a blog called Scam of the Month. And you highlighted an interesting story in your latest Scam of the Month published on your site earlier. Talk about this.
Oh, okay, that story? Yes, you know.
I think it had to do with a coin dealer that was scammed.
Yes, correct. You know, there was a, you know, they are a gold and bullion company based in the East Coast, and they sell gold and silver coins. They are a very legit business, and anywhere from $29.99 to $40,000. $29.99, you know, yeah, they do get chargebacks because, you know, they advertise in magazines. They would sell it to anybody. But these higher-end coins, rare coins, collectible coins, that are only sold to a select group of customers, you know, and they have a customized concierge service where, you know, they talk about their collection. They want to make sure that, you know, the customer, you know, is interested in completing a collection, you know. So it's a very high-end deal. It's a, you know, $40,000 transaction. That's a lot of money, you know, for a coin, right? So
yes. This
customer expressed interest in the coin, you know, and they do payment plans, obviously. So they did agree to the payment plan, and they got some signatures and stuff. And, you know, through the concierge service, the customer purchased the coin, and it was delivered, and there was signature confirmation. And then suddenly they get a chargeback. And the merchant was surprised, and they call up the customer and ask them, what is the reason for this chargeback? The customer said that they never got the coin, but the merchant is, you know, dumbfounded because they have signature confirmation. But then, you know, they went back and forth, and by the time they could, you know, even respond, the deadline had passed. And that's one thing businesses may not realize, that it's a hard deadline. If you do not submit the required documents and evidence before or on or before the deadline, you're done. You don't have a recourse. So the customer got back, and then they, you know, they filed a the merchant filed a claim with their carrier, and the carrier did an investigation, and they found out, the customer told them, you know, in confidence, that yeah, I got the product, because they didn't want to lie to the carrier, because a carrier would file an insurance claim and all of that, right? So but then, you know, when the merchant tried to reopen the case, you know what, card association said, deadline gone, you can't reopen this case, and the case is closed. So the merchant is left without any recourse other than maybe pursuing some legal means, or, you know, it's just going through more and more loops and, you know, like just hoops, jumping through hoops.
Right. And this is the thing that I find so offensive is that, first of all, this is not a small transaction. This is a very big transaction. And this is a merchant. This merchant makes tons of money for the processing, provider there. And you think that the provider would have said, okay, you know what, this is a big transaction, we'll make an exception. But yeah, it doesn't surprise me that this happened. It is such a time-consuming process. And as you said earlier, most people don't know what to do. They don't know how to deal with it, and they're already busy. So this is like putting on a new job on top of what they're already doing.
You hit the nail on the head. That's right. You know, we have been merchants ourselves. My co-founder and I, you know, we are business partners too, and we're married. And we have started many different businesses. And when we started our business, we faced chargebacks many, many years ago, more than 10, 12 years ago. And it was like this dark, mysterious world of chargebacks. And, you know, honestly, I could not find information as to what should I do, you know, who's going, how do I win the money back? Because I know these were legitimate transactions. This was for a business contract, too. And I had all the evidence, but nobody was there to guide me through the process or even give me information as to what I should do to prevent and fight the chargeback to win the money back. So it's completely unfair, I think. Like you said, the processors and banks, they do charge hefty fees, especially when you get a chargeback. The merchant gets hit with a chargeback processing fee, which can never be recovered. You know, that's something the bank charges anyway. And they lose the money, lose the chargeback amount, they lose the product, and they get hit with fees. And also, they need to, you know, restock the inventory, and they have more money going out just to fight these chargebacks or to prevent chargebacks. So I think, you know, in our company, we take the approach of being a merchant advocate. Merchants and businesses come to us because they can trust the advice we give them because we are on their side. To that extent, we even provide a, you know, guarantee where we call it the guru guarantee. We want them to make more money than what we charge them. We want them to have gains and profit from the services we provide in terms of bottom line as well as in terms of prevention, customer reputation, satisfaction, so many other things, you know, that go into running a successful business.
Yes, absolutely. No, this is this is an amazing thing. The thing that, again, that you don't understand, that a lot of people don't understand, when you, the merchant, receive a chargeback, you mentioned the chargeback fee that's unrecoverable. This is sometimes like a flat fee of $50, but I've seen it as high as $150.
Yes, it really varies depending on the bank and the processor. You know, there are people, I mean, sometimes, you know, it depends on the industry that the merchant is in and the processor and bank they go to. There are some merchants that are considered high risk. These high risk merchants get hit with the most fees. And, you know, the high risk category consists of a certain industry type, certain business types, and, you know, typically online, e-commerce, when the card is not present, they call it the CNP space, card not present space. And especially when they sell, you know, things like supplements or digital goods, or even high ticket items, you know, like the car coin dealer, you know, those are considered high risk transactions. So they get hit with the most fees.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, one more thing, you know, some merchants are not aware of this. In the high-risk space especially, banks also hold a certain amount, the dollar amount, let's say 10%, every month as a reserve to protect the banks from chargebacks. So that's called a rolling reserve. So the merchant is very, you know, the profit margin or the cash flow for the merchant is tightened because of the reserve, you know. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
They don't want to take any risk. Trust me.
They don't. They don't. And you know what? And what's funny to me is this is, as far as I'm concerned, look, if you are just starting out a business and you're in this high, and you're, what do you call it, high risk space, a rolling reserve kind of makes sense for a short term. But once you've been established, you think that they would work with you. And the reality is they don't. They simply do not care. Now, having said that, that's why a lot of these merchant processors are, you know, have come into the space. PayPal is changing that a little bit. Stripe and some of these other smaller processors are changing that, but still a long ways to go. And bottom line is, it's that, as we've already said, Sri, it's that you're taking on a full-time job because it is a mysterious dark world and you have time limits that expire. Let's talk about this. What are some things that an e-commerce merchant can do that can help them from getting hit by chargebacks? Let's talk about that.
Oh, sure. That's a great question. We get asked about this all the time. I can tell you that. And those, you know, like I said, we are a merchant advocate. We educate our merchants as well, you know, so that's one of the first things we do. So, you know, there are many things that a merchant can do to protect themselves from chargebacks. For example, the descriptor on the credit card statement. You know, make sure the merchant needs to make sure that the customer can understand or recognize the name of the company or the product, and make sure that you have the contact, the phone number right there on the description. You want the customer to contact you, not the credit card company, right? So make sure that the descriptor appears correctly. You know, I would even make some test orders on different credit cards as a merchant, and then on my credit card statement, I'd look up my descriptor and make sure it appears correct, you know? And also make sure that you answer your phone calls and emails on time. I cannot stress this enough. You have a customer service number. You should display it everywhere, on your product, on your website, on all the pages, you know, on the credit card statement. And make sure your call center knows they got to answer it within 30 seconds or less. You don't want to make them wait on hold so that they call the credit card company. So, you know, many merchants actually fail to do that. And make sure that, you know, you can provide service as long as possible, maybe 24/7, maybe at least 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, 6 days a week, something like that. Make sure you have trained representatives who can provide great customer service. And also, I would think that the merchant needs to make sure the customer understands the payment terms. Because sometimes, you know, they can be tricky, especially online. You know, I've gone on websites where I'm like, okay, what am I signing up for? Is this a monthly trial? Is this, you know, what are the cancellation policy? Or, you know, it's not clear to me. So I would ask merchants to make sure that the customer fully understands the purchase terms before the order is placed, and also make sure they understand what the product or the service is about, what the benefits they get, et cetera, you know? It sounds simple, but some websites make it really tricky, and if guess what? The customer doesn't want any hassles. They're just going to call the credit card company, you know?
Right, and you know what? And I can attest to that because that's what I've done. I have bought things online, and then, you know, and so I'm unhappy with it, or I didn't get it. I forgot. I know I did this recently, and the merchant is non-responsive. You know, I give them 24 hours via email. They don't have an easy to locate phone number. So after 24 hours, if I haven't heard from them, I go directly to my credit card and say, hey, I'm unhappy with this charge. They're not responding. Boom. And so, yeah, it's they're going to process it. And the thing about it is, merchants, if you guys are taking people's money online, you have to be responsive. You know, this suggestion of having, what do you call it, making it easy for the individual to contact you. You know, something that I've seen on some of these charge descriptors is they'll have the name of the company and the customer service number on the descriptor.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that's the way to do it because, okay, it's from Bert Martinez and his phone number is right there. I may not recognize the name Bert Martinez, but at least I'm going to call him and verify why they charged my card before I charge back.
Exactly. And also, you know, I think merchants can should monitor their social media. Nowadays, customers are using so many different avenues for contacting businesses. Monitor your social media and respond to customers that way as well. Email, phone, and social media are most crucial in you know, preventing chargebacks. And, you know, another thing is, you know, when a representative is talking to a customer, make sure they're trained to provide customer service. You know, too many times I've seen merchants, we make test calls, by the way. We always make test calls to make sure that, you know, the call center or the representatives are doing a great job in providing customer service. And make sure the customer service representatives understand the importance of preventing chargebacks.
Because,
you know, call center reps don't know, I mean, may not even know what a chargeback is, or, you know, they don't know anything about prevention. So it's our duty as merchants to train our call center staff and any other customer service staff about the importance of chargebacks and prevention chargebacks and why they need to be very courteous with customers. And, for example, if a bank rep calls on the line, nowadays customers are calling with bank reps on the line. So what do? You need to have a policy for that. You know, typically give them a refund if they're not happy. Don't argue with them. Don't negotiate with them. Just give them a refund because, you know, the bank rep is on the line.
Yeah, you know what? And it's funny you should say that because, matter of fact, the last chargeback I did, the Chase Bank representative stayed on the phone with me.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to get a hold of the merchant, couldn't get a hold of the merchant. And so that's, you know, they recorded the fact that they couldn't, you know, that the phone rang and it went to voicemail. And so they went ahead, you know, and the Chase Bank representative say, hey, this is so-and-so with Chase Bank. We're letting you know we're charging your card back because nobody could get a hold of you. You know what? And what's so funny was this is a small transaction. I don't think it was more than $20 or $25, but it's going to cost that merchant $50 to process that chargeback because they did not have a solid response system for their customers.
Yes, absolutely. And it counts against them as far as their threshold goes.
Ooh, yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's
and
talk about this real quick.
These processors, banks are closely monitoring the thresholds nowadays. Their risk departments, they have huge risk departments analyzing every merchant account every day.
Let's talk about this. Chargeback gurus, what do you guys do?
Well, we help e-commerce businesses fight, prevent, and recover money from chargebacks and fraud. That's it in a nutshell.
Excellent. So,
and
okay, and I love
many
that.
So, achieve that goal.
If I have an e-commerce business, I hire chargeback gurus to help me sort this out, and this is what you guys take care of.
We take care of this, yes. From day one, we first analyze the merchant's business. We do a risk and vulnerability assessment because we want to know what the merchant is doing currently, what they should do, should not do. We give them detailed reports. And we come on board, we analyze their chargeback patterns. And if there are any, you know, urgent chargebacks with deadlines, we take care of them right away. We file chargeback documentation on time. We have chargeback experts and analysts reviewing every case before we file documents. We make sure we win money back for our merchants. Plus, we also work on different strategies and policies to prevent chargebacks and fraud.
I love it. I love it. Now, do you guys work on a monthly subscription fee type basis, or is it on a case-by-case basis? How do you guys service your customers?
Typically it's monthly. You know, we have a monthly service. We typically ask our merchants to try our services for like 90 days, and, you know, we give them the guarantee. We want them to be profitable and make more money than what they pay us, right? So,
right.
And then depending on the service, we have service charges. You know, for example, if they want us to fight chargebacks, it could be a per chargeback fee. And if there are other services, you know, every service has their own fee patterns. And, you know, we work with the merchant because we want them to make more money and also protect their business. So we understand the needs of small, medium, and large businesses, and so we customize our proposals based on their needs.
I love it. I love it. Chargeback Gurus. Is it chargebackgurus.com?
Yes, exactly. Our website is chargebackgurus.com. And, you know, the listeners can go to our website, just get education, tips, and advice on what they can do today to prevent chargebacks, to fight chargebacks. And we also have a guide right now, I think. It's going up today, about how they can protect themselves against what we call friendly fraud. although in my book, it's the most unfriendly fraud ever for merchants.
So friendly fraud that's not really that friendly.
No, no. When a customer knowingly files a chargeback, no, it's not friendly.
Yeah. Well, and I think you gave a great example with that coin guy. That was a great example of fraud as well as friendly chargebacks. Well, listen, we're out of time, Sri. Love to have you back. Love to have you come back, talk more about business and chargeback. The guys, go check out chargebackgurus.com. Sri, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure. Have a great
Alrighty,
day.
Good
thank
stuff
you
there from Sri Shrivenson. And the company is called Chargeback Gurus. Sri, I was just been informed that you need to change the batteries in your smoke detector because our listeners were hearing that. Sorry, but that's all right. Anyway, good stuff there about you and your merchant account, how you can protect your business from fraud, from chargebacks, and from the insidious friendly chargebacks. We're going to take a quick commercial break. And then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Caller Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All righty, folks. We are back. My next guest, John Pollack. John Pollack is the CEO of Financial Gravity Holdings and president of Pollack Advisory Group, a registered investment advisory firm. He's certified tax coach and a certified wealth strategist. John can be heard on Financial Gravity with John Pollack podcast, where he discusses tax reduction strategies for small businesses and retirees. And you can check him out at johnpollackinc.com, johnpollackinc.com. John Pollack, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
You bet, you bet. You know what? I think that a lot of people don't think about taxes as a way to leverage or maximize their wealth. And so I want to start off by talking about that. I want to talk about, taxes as a way of leveraging your wealth.
Yeah, so one of the challenges that we run into in the marketplace is that people think that taxes are – they've heard the saying by Ben Franklin, there's two certainties in life, death and taxes. And it's partially true, not the death part. That is a certainty. It's partially true about the taxes because there are 70,000 pages of code. And we've been trying to teach people that is their moral obligation to pay the least amount as allowable by law. And why? Because your kids deserve to go to better colleges. You deserve to have a better vacation. You deserve to have more capital in your business so that you can grow it. Those are all things that you deserve. And the tax code allows for you to access more money. It's just everyone's afraid of the IRS because they're this boogeyman. And frankly, they're not. They've have less teeth now than they've ever had. And the code is more complicated than it's ever been, which is huge opportunity for small business owners to tap into that code and maximize. And it's not going to increase – this is the other thing. It doesn't increase audit risk. I can't even begin to say this more emphatically. Your audit risk does not go up when you use tax code. It goes up when you don't use it. So I'll give you an example. This to me was insane. We had a doctor who was making $2 million a year. That was his net income, pre-tax. He was probably netting about $1 million because he was in a state with a high tax too. So he was paying about $1 million a year in taxes, and he did not want to work with us because he believed that if he did, he would become an audit risk. Where the exact opposite was true. He was a sole proprietor, which is 5 times more likely to be audited than an S-corp. So if all he had to do is move from a sole proprietor to an S-corp, his audit risk would have dropped precipitously, but he wouldn't even do that. And his taxes would have gone down because he was paying self-employment tax, and the self-employment tax would have been eliminated. And on $2 million, even 1% is a lot of money, but you know, self-employment tax is much higher than that. So it's one of those things that we're fighting this uphill battle to get people to keep the money that's rightfully theirs. It's really remarkable.
And that is remarkable. First of all, this goes to show you, whether you're Donald Duck or Donald Trump, we're all fighting these glass ceilings, these fear, mm-hmm. These preset fears. Here's a guy who's a successful businessman. He's a smart guy because he's a doctor. He's making $2 million a year, and yet he's afraid to take on your services and reduce his tax liability because he's afraid of being audited, and that just makes no sense.
It doesn't, and so I wasn't the sales rep on the call. One of my team members was, and I said, well, if you can get back to him, ask him this question. For $500,000, would he be comfortable with the type of attorneys that he would be able to hire to fight an IRS audit?
Mm.
$500,000 a year is what we were going to be able to save this guy. Minimum.
Unbelievable.
So
Unbelievable.
It's just nuts. But that's a very extreme case. But we have smaller cases where someone comes in and we can save them $20,000 a year, $10,000 a year, and they're like, I don't know if I'm comfortable with this. Or they'll go back to their CPA, which we can spend a whole show on this. They go back to their CPA, and the CPA is kind of will throw up their hands and say, I'm not comfortable with that, which is my favorite saying from a CPA. You're not comfortable with it. Is it illegal? Well, no. Is it immoral? Well, no. Is it unethical? No. So, yeah, I'm not comfortable with it. And that, by the way, has happened so many times. That's why I repeat the story, because it wasn't like one situation. It happened over and over and over again. That's why we got into the business.
Right.
We were doing
it's not because
we wanted to be here.
and what happens when you're dealing with professionals, mm-hmm. because, you know, CPAs, you know, attorneys, people in your industry, because you're regulated so heavily, some people rather not make a decision and therefore they're not liable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so easy to say, I'm not comfortable with that. You know what? You're going to have to make your own decision on that. I'm not going to advise you on that. And this is just a pussy's ways out. I mean, that's the only thing you can do about it. If my CPA said something as vague as I'm not comfortable with that, I would fire him. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You're not comfortable. You got to give me specifics.
Yeah. Comfortable why? You said it was legal, it was moral, and it was ethical, and you're not comfortable with it? That's just nuts. Well, it could create audit risk. Well, Mr. CPA, you get paid for two things, hourly and forms. I'm pretty sure an audit would create more hours and more forms. So if I want to save money on taxes and I'm willing to pay you more money, why wouldn't you want to implement that? It's actually in your best interest so CPAs are a very unique business problem. What's interesting is we have 600 to be exact, CPAs in our network. So I pick on them a lot, but I try to separate between CPA 1.0 and 2.0. 1.0 is the ones that have been through the CPA exam,
right.
Which, by the way, the CPA exam has no tax planning in it. And this is another weird, strange problem we have in our marketplaces. We are competing with an industry that doesn't do the thing that we do, but everybody thinks they do the thing that we do, which is tax plan. I mean, imagine trying to, doctors competing with chiropractors because everyone thinks chiropractors cure the common cold. And the chiropractor doesn't advertise that they cure it, but everyone just thinks it. That's what we have with the CPA industry. Everybody thinks the accounting industry is tax planners because that's why they get the designation. But the word A, the A in the CPA is accountant, and accountants are basically numbers historians. So they just record what you've done. They're not real good at saying, you know what, if you put this number in a different box amongst the 70,000 pages of code, we can save you a lot of money. So that's something that – and realistically, the reason I got into this business wasn't because I wanted to be here. It was because I was doing well. I was getting hammered in taxes. It was the first Obama election where I kept hearing over and over, rich people don't pay their fair share. And I was thinking, well, if this isn't fair, this seems way more beyond fair than what I believe it to be. So I decided that I didn't want to pay my fair share either if rich people aren't doing it. And I realized that the tax code is written for all of us universally. Rich people do not have a secret handshake and a special door they can go beyond and get special tax privileges. They have the same exact laws that we have. It's just they're using them and we're not. So I wanted to make those laws accessible to the smaller business owners so that they can grow their businesses. Because if we put the money back in the hands of the business owner, the economy will grow. If we keep sending it to the federal government, it won't. So, and they gave us the rules. So let's play by their rules and win.
Absolutely. And I like what you said. First of all, they gave us the rules. There's nothing wrong with playing with the rules. Second of all, I want to talk about what you said in the very beginning of the segment, and that is it is your obligation, your duty, your responsibility to pay as little as taxes as possible, long as it's legal, following the code. So if you so if you are supporting children, you get tax breaks for that. If you have a business, you get tax breaks for that. And therefore, not to take those tax breaks is irresponsible. And let me tell you, the way the IRS works, they don't say, hey, you know what, Bert, you didn't take all the deductions you were supposed to take the last 10 years, so we're going to let you slide moving forward. They don't care about the past. They want their cake, and they want to be able to eat it too. And so I love this idea of following the code, paying what you owe, but not paying more than what you owe.
Yeah, not one dime. And the thing is that the code is so – it's an embarrassment of riches is what it is. It's so deep with opportunities. It's just – it's silly that people aren't using it. I mean, it's funny because I'll have someone come in and I'll say, well, are you writing off your mortgage interest? Well, of course I am. Well, why are you doing that and not doing what I'm recommending? Well, it's more common knowledge. Oh, so that's the key, common knowledge. So, it's funny because those guys are usually pulling into, or they don't want to pay our fees, and they pull into the parking lot in a Lexus. And I'm like, well, if you really care about our fees, drive a Toyota. Why are you driving a Lexus? It's twice as expensive, And I have a guaranteed return on my investment. It's really strange to hear the reasoning people make around the tax code. It makes people weird. I don't know what it is about it. Is people are afraid of it because they don't understand it. It's not that complex. There are things there that are amazing. Pardon?
I think you hit the nail on the head, and that is people simply do not understand it. It scares them. They don't want to dive into it. Look, here's the problem I have. The biggest problem I have with the IRS code is that the IRS agents themselves do not know the code. And because they don't know the code, any information they give you, they're not bound by the accuracy of that information, because they don't want to be upheld to something that may be wrong. So when you're dealing with an agent, and if you call the IRS number, you're put on hold. You'll get that recorded message that says any information given to you is, it doesn't necessarily mean accuracy and or dependable. I mean,
That's nuts. Which, by the way, works to your advantage. If they don't know what the code is, then why aren't you using the code that it actually exists? Because if I tell you that you can write your house off 14 days a year, it's in the code. And it's not 15, it's 14. It's very specific. The code is, law is very interesting that way. It's the letter of the law, it's not the spirit. The letter of the law says you can write your house 14 days off a year. So, and you have to follow certain rules, but the reality is it's there. So why aren't we using it? There's even a line on one of the forms that says 14-day rental rule in an empty box. So it's funny because we've taken that to CPAs, and we even show them on the form where you're supposed to put the number. The number's there, but it doesn't affect your income. So it does affect it, in fact, that it reduces it. But CPAs still won't use it. It's like, well, the IRS knows that it's part of the code. They wouldn't have even put a box on the form for it if it wasn't in the code. And it's just strange. But it's there. We should be using – and there's dozens of these. So for those people that are listening that are really well off, there's a part of the code that allows you to stash $1 million a year tax-free. $1 million. And it gets better.
Wow.
Congress, a Republican Congress, and a Democrat president – enhanced the law last December so that in January of 2017, that goes from $1.2 million a year you can stash to $2.2 million. So if the Democrats and the Republicans agreed on the tax law, why would you not use that?
Okay, I got to stop you there.
Yeah.
I don't want to take up a whole lot of time talking about this, but you got to give us a little synopsis. How can I stash $1 million a year? You're saying $1 million a year, not $1 million in lifetime, but $1 million a year in tax-free money. How, doing what?
So what it's basically a it's an indemnification program where you're creating kind of an insurance company on yourself. So you have to have something that's insurable risk that an insurance company will not cover, which is very easy to create. I mean, if you're a doctor, there's all kinds of insurable risks. You're the only if you're a doctor and you're a surgeon and your hands get broken, that's an insurable risk. Well, there's probably not an insurance company that's going to insure just your hands. So what you have to work – it's very complex how it works. So I make it sound – it's almost flippant in how easy it sounds. Oh, you can stash $1 million a year. Things have to be set up. It costs tens of thousands of dollars a year. But if you stash $1 million a year, you're in the 50% tax bracket. Most people don't know this, is that it goes 39.6. And if you're in the 39.6, you're adding the 3.8 Obamacare tax. Also, there's two other taxes. One's about 2% and one's about 3% that are phase-out taxes. So once you reach a certain threshold, none of your deductions count. So you end up around a 50% tax bracket before you add the states in. So if you're in a state that has another 8 to 10%, you're at 60. So to stash $1 million and you're in a 60% tax bracket, you can save $600,000 a year. But we charge you, and we don't charge it, the companies we work with do, charge you $50,000 in fees to do all the accounting and legal work. It's a bargain. Let's see, $50,000 in fees to save $600,000 in taxes. Yeah, I'd write that check. And that's what we do. And you can go down as low as $250,000. I'd like to throw out the big numbers because they're good for radio. But reality is most of our clients don't have $1 million to stash.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know what? And it's amazing to me. And again, this is what you've been saying, but I want to emphasize this. It's amazing how many people are busting their humps to make more money, and they don't want to engage or retain somebody with your knowledge and your expertise to help reduce their taxes. And you have to have a tax plan just like you have to have a retirement plan, just like you have to have a marketing plan or a financial plan.
Yeah, and the tax plan is your single biggest expense. So people will try to cut their food costs if they're a restaurant. They'll try to cut their overhead costs on any kind of business. But their single biggest expense in the business, no one's even talking about. Our average right now for a small business owner is $20,000 a year. So let's kind of focus on the impact of $20,000 a year for a small business owner. First of all, this is $20,000 they've already earned. You do not owe $20,000 in taxes unless you earned it first. So you're writing a check to the government that's your money that you don't – it's not like we're finding money. It's not like advertising. If you spend X, we hope to do Y. This is if you spend X, we will get you Y because the money is already yours. We just have to build a plan to make sure that you keep it. Some things are harder than others. We've had clients say, you know what, I'll do this plan. I'm not going to do this because it seems like more work than it's worth, which is that's a business decision. At least you're saying I'm not going to spend $1,000 to save $500. That makes sense. But if you're going to spend $1,000 to save $20,000, it would not make sense not to do that. You would have to do something like that. Any business owner would. So that's what we're trying to help people understand, is that this is your single biggest expense. This is money you've already earned. And if your profit margin is 10% and we save you $20,000, that's $200,000 in revenue that you don't have to generate to make that payment. So the impact on what we do is it's far-reaching. It's guaranteed. We guarantee we'll double people's money. And I'll just tell you this, just between you and me, there's actually about a 12x. So for every dollar that someone pays us, we're getting about, on average, 12 times the money back in returns. But no one would believe if we sold that, so we just do a 2x promise.
And again, speaking of advertising, I'm a big believer. Look, if you can spend a dollar in advertising and get a dollar and 20 cents back, that's a 20% return. That's that's a bare minimum good deal. You know, now obviously we try to get 100% that, you know, so if you spend a dollar, you get two back. But, so I want to put that, look at this in different terms. So in your case, if I'm, if you can save me 2X, 3X, 5X, 10X, why wouldn't I at least look at that? I mean, you have to be seriously dead or mentally ill not to look at what John Pollock has to offer. Whether or not I believe you, I have to at least, as a good business person, as somebody who has a responsibility to my family, I'm going to have to look at financial gravity and say, okay, let's see if this person knows anything they're talking about. I got to get John on the phone and at least feel him out.
Yeah, I mean, and that's we've tried to reduce the barrier. So we have found that there's basically three barriers to our business. First is they think the CPA does it. First of all, they're afraid of the audit, so we have to overcome that. The second is they think their CPA is already doing it, which they're not. The question we ask is, when was the last time a CPA gave you advice that saved you at least $1,000 this year in taxes? To which everybody answers, well, never. So, right. And then the third thing is that we are actually the solution. So number one, you're not going to get audited by using the tax code. Number two, the CPA is not trained for this, is not good at this. And number three, financial gravity is trained at this, is good at it, and we can help you. So those are the three things we have to overcome. Really, we're spending more time on the first two, is convincing people right. that. Because once they've convinced of that, they've never heard that this can be done before. So their attitude is, well, you introduced me to the concept, so I guess I'll just go ahead and trust you. And that's why we've grown. We are recruiting offices nationwide, and we've grown nationwide as a direct result. It's really one of these strange things that I kept saying to myself: there has got to be a business that already does this. There's no way I can be a first mover in this. And frankly, we are. It's really a strange. Basically, I found a hole in the marketplace, and I'm trying to run a Mack truck through it.
I love it. Okay, so you know what? And what's interesting, I want to talk about this, is that, again, you have some of the same obstacles that all businesses have, and that is the customer doesn't know you. You got to reduce their fear or eliminate their fear, reduce their risk of doing business with you, which you do. And we all hit these hurdles. We all are impacted by these emotions. And you just have to get inside your customer's head and say, listen, do you want to give $100,000 to the IRS or whatever the amount is? You want to give X amount of dollars to the IRS, or would you like to risk a smaller amount and let us save you that amount? And again, that comes from education, and it comes from people know, like, and trusting you. And I want to point this out. You have a YouTube channel with over 500 videos. Why do you have 500 videos on a YouTube channel? Because you want people to get to know, like, and trust you. And,
right.
And this is a great example that anybody can do this, because we all hit the same hurdles, is getting people to know, like, and trust us. And that's the only way they're going to give us their money. So I want to talk about this.
And that's,
quick.
By the way, why I went towards podcasting. We had a radio show in the Dallas Metroplex, but radio shows expire. You do them and they're gone. So there wasn't a way for someone to get to know, like, and trust me unless they listened to me at 12 o'clock on Saturday every week. And realistically,
right.
I was not vain enough to think that people were, it's 12 o'clock, I should listen to John. It was more like, I'm in the car. That happened to be the station that was on when I parked the car on Friday. I'll just go listen to what
right.
this guy has to say. We did good with it for a while, but now we're creating a library of ideas that I don't have to repeat. So now I can, start doing case studies because radio is more, for me, it was an infomercial. I had to pay to be there. I had to sell the entire time. I couldn't give out information or new information week after week because I had to pay, justify my existence. Podcasting allows me to create better content and have content that's evergreen, so people can go back 10 years from now and hear what I said. That's what the YouTube videos are. I mean, it's actually fun to see my evolution. My first video through, we haven't done a whole lot of new videos recently, but you can see my hair evolve, from a darker color to a lighter color. and a thicker look to a thinner look.
You know, at least you have color. You can watch my hair evolve from having hair to having no hair. So,
So you get to see that there's evolutions that you get to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, it's funny. We have a poster of a book that I did a long time ago, and it's got everyone picks on me from the office. It's like, what's with the brown hair?
Oh,
I had brown hair. They said, you should color it. I said, why? It was too hard to earn this hair. There's no way I'm coloring it.
Oh, okay, so let me ask you this, because I know that this is a question that a lot of our entrepreneurs, a lot of our CEOs, C-suite people want to ask, and that is it better to lease a car or to buy a car?
Ooh, good question. So there's a couple ways to look at it. If you're kind of a Ramsey fan and you just want no debt, then obviously it's better just to buy because you hate debt. But from a purely tax efficiency standpoint, it's actually better to lease. Now, what happens is that people will make sloppy – just because it's a good tax strategy, you also have to balance in good finance strategy. So the illustration I use is if I'm starting a gardening business, I don't go out and lease a new $65,000 Tundra because John says it's a good tax, you know, strategy. I could lease a used 5-year-old Tundra and still get the same tax strategy with a much lower payment. So just because you're doing good tax things, like in this case, doesn't necessarily mean it's always good financial principles. Another illustration I use when people are in my office is that when you're in my office, the conference room table I have is actually a dining room table because dining room tables are pretty nice, and they're a fraction of a cost of a conference room table. I can buy a $10,000 mahogany conference room table, and that would be a great tax deduction. It would be a $10,000 deduction. Or I can spend $1,000 and get a nice dining room table, and it works for the conference room. So financially, it's smarter to buy the dining room table. So when I say leasing is smarter, you can't take a smarter tax strategy and then do something dumb by buying overbuying. So don't go buy a Tesla if you can't afford. So what I tell people is the rule of thumb is if you can't pay cash for it, then you shouldn't be leasing it.
Gotcha.
So if you want to buy a new Maserati for $120,000 and you can't pay cash for it, then don't lease it. If you can pay cash, if you can scrape together enough cash to buy a $25,000 Camry, which most business owners, come hell or high water, probably could. They probably wouldn't want to, but they could. Then buy the Camry, lease it, pay $300 a month, write the lease off. Now, if you're doing tons of miles, then it makes a lot of sense to actually write the mileage off because you can write off many times more dollars than you could if you lease. So there is some give and take, but leasing overall is the better, more efficient strategy. The way I explain it to people is think of all the money that you earn coming in one side of a large chasm, and you have to pay a toll to get it across the chasm. So you have to kind of use a toll bridge.
So what we want to try to do is
spend as much money pre-toll bridge. So by
toll bridge.
What Ramsey's saying is he'll say, well, earn $50,000, pay 40% to cross the toll bridge. Now I have $30,000 left. Now I can pay cash for a car. Well, what did the car really cost you? It cost you $50 to pay a $30,000 car. If I lease it, then a $50,000 car, I can buy a $50,000 car. So I actually now can buy a better car, or I can spend $30,000 on a car, which I would have had to do if I crossed the toll bridge, by leasing it, and that gives me an extra $20,000 to keep in my business. So that's where there's a gap. And small business owners, I try to get them away from thinking about trying to live their life debt-free because we're taking risks anyways. I mean, if you're a small business owner, you're kind of wired dysfunctionally in a little bit of life. I mean, I know I'm dysfunctional, so because I'm willing
I'm
to do things that
–
yeah, I mean, it's there's some great books on this, The Hypermanic Edge and all this stuff where basically it shows that entrepreneurs – you know, I tell people all the time, you may like what I've created, but you do not want to be me. I can assure you.
Right.
You do not want to be inside this head. It's always
on. Going back to your example there, you know, and I like what you're talking about. Hey, if you cannot afford to pay cash for it, if you normally could not afford a $600 payment, then don't get a $600 lease or whatever. I think that's
right.
A great example.
Just to get a deductible.
Just to get a deductible. You still have to be smart. Now, something I'm playing around with this year, I had a car. My other son went to college. I gave him my car. It was paid off. It was It was paid off. And so for a couple of weeks there, I'm using Uber to get around. And
nice. It's deductible.
And I'm thinking,
by the way, what you're doing is going to be the way things are done 10 years from now.
Well, and so,
we're not
so going to
own
out.
Cars.
Yeah, because you know what? Here's the deal. So I was going to do this for 2 weeks while I bought a new car. Well, at the end of 2 weeks, I thought, I'm enjoying this experience so much. I don't have to worry about texting. I don't have to worry about talking and driving. I don't have to worry about doing anything. I can sit in the back. I can do a video if I want. I can do whatever. And so my first month, it was supposed to only be 2 weeks. At the end of that 2 weeks, I decided to keep going. So my first 30 days of Ubering around, I spent about $100, $120. My second month, because I did a lot more, I spent about close to $180. And now I'm back to about $100 and $120. My point being is that's pretty inexpensive. I can't lease a car for less than that.
No.
The whole
you
thing
can't lease a car you'd want to lease for that.
Thank you. Yeah. And so I'm deducting the Uber experience, if you will. And so that includes a driver, gas, and insurance for $120 a month.
And you're working while you're doing it. So
thank
even
you.
If you didn't
–
I've been telling people this for a couple of years now. I said Uber is the future. They will come out with a driverless car, which they are now testing in Pittsburgh. And when they do, it'll eliminate the driver. And there's going to be a day where you can actually summon the type of Uber car you want. Well, I want an Uber car that has a desk in it. I want an Uber car that has a conference table because there's three of us. Because why? You don't need steering wheels. You're not going to need drivers. So you're going to be able to start to do things like this. And if I can work at a desk on my way to the airport, why would I buy a car?
Right.
It's not. This is something a lot of people don't know. But they're designing malls right now with parking garages with the intention of converting the parking garages into more shopping space. So they're actually making the outside walls breakable so that at some point when people stop driving and parking at the mall because they're just going to Uber, they're going to, pull up their app and just get to the mall and just get out and no one's going to be parking anymore. So the malls are actually designing the malls today to not need the parking garages. They're designing them with parking garages not to need the parking garages.
I love it. I love it. John Pollock, we're out of time. I love our conversation today. It's been a blast having you on the show. Looking forward to having you back again, my friend. It was great to meet you today. And again, if you guys want to find out more about John, you can go to Google John Pollock, or you can go to financialgravityholdings.com. Is that right?
No, just go financialgravity.com, or you can go to johnpollockinc.com. And we actually have a free ebook on these tax strategies. So I highly recommend you download it because it's free.
Financialgravity.com. I love it. Financialgravity.com. John Pollock, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Thanks for having me.
All righty. Good stuff there about you and your money. I mean, I love John's enthusiasm and his passion. Doesn't he make taxes more fun? Just sitting around talking to John about taxes makes taxes more fun. And I think that gives you an insight as to what might happen if you work with him. Check him out at financialgravity.com. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.